This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark AmTower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. AmTower Off-Center with your host, Mark AmTower.
Welcome to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. I've corresponded with my guest today on and off via LinkedIn, email, and when I heard he was leaving government, I said, I really want you on the show. So, Simone Sigmund, welcome to AmTower Off-Center.
Thank you very much, Mark. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming. Long time coming, man. So let's start off with telling people a little bit about your background, because you were in government for almost 20.
Yes. Yeah, I started my government career working at the National Institute of Standards and Technology as a member of the technical staff there doing research. After having spent a few years there, I felt like I was ready for a change. And at the same time, an opportunity came up to pursue a detail assignment at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. And I moved over there and became a senior policy analyst for information technology. And that was a very interesting role, being involved in a variety of policy issues that were prominent at the time, including cybersecurity, IT research and development, and high-performance computing. It was certainly an interesting time to be working there. From there, I moved over to the Department of Homeland Security and became the first director of cybersecurity R&D and helped establish the long-term budget portfolios and technology portfolios and research agenda for cybersecurity R&D at DHS. And that was also an exciting...
Was there a budget for it then? Because we're talking probably 10 years ago now, right?
Yeah, at the time, the budget was very small. Science and Technology was a brand new organization, one of the few parts of DHS that was new, as opposed to being an existing component of the government that got moved into DHS. The budget when I arrived there for cybersecurity R&D, I believe, if I recall correctly, was around $4 million. I think it's upwards of $80 million now, so it's certainly grown over time. But it was a modest portfolio when we first got it off the ground.
So you defined some requirements.
Yes, and it was back in the days when DHS really felt like a startup organization. So it was an exciting time to be there, very, very formative.
Then you went back to your home, my favorite playground.
NIST. I did, yes. From there, I moved to a position where I was responsible for coordinating interagency R&D before moving back to NIST. And then, having spent the first roughly half of my career in that R&D, S&T world, wanted to make a change in my career and get more into operations and higher level management. So I moved over to NIST and became the CIO at NIST. I was there for a little over 3 years and had an opportunity. I was invited by the Deputy Secretary of Commerce to move up to the commerce level and become the commerce CIO. And that was a hard position to turn down, so I did end up moving there and
even
was there.
You had to drive into D.C. instead of just out to Gaithersburg.
Yeah, the commute was not as good. Even today, I live about 5 minutes away from NIST, so if commuting were my main priority, I would probably still be working there.
Well, maybe with your new gig, you can get a contract there and visit home.
You never know. You never know.
E.T., call home. So 19 years in government. We know some of the same people. Did you know Amit Yoran? He did a very brief stint at
I did.
DHS.
DHS. Yes, DHS, I was on the S&T side when he was over there as director of the cybersecurity division before it became an assistant secretary position. He was my primary internal customer. We had external customers in the private sector, the critical infrastructure sectors, but we were also focused on R&D to meet the internal needs for DHS. process, and we interacted frequently, got a lot of input from the National Cybersecurity Division on what the research agenda should look like. So yeah, we worked often together.
I had a theory about, and you don't have to verify this or not, I had a theory as to why he left. He was from Silicon Valley, and he was used to things occurring somewhat more quickly.
I certainly don't want to speak for him, but I think if your listeners want to go back and check the record, I think he was probably on the record expressing a little bit of frustration about how quickly or not quickly things moved in the government.
Yeah, and you know, it was a good move to bring him in because he was very high profile at the time, and he was at that cutting edge of all of the cyber issues.
Yeah.
And but again, the reason I asked the funding thing is I've been following cyber since 1992, when I was asked to be on the board of the National Computer Security Association, and not for technology, for marketing. But there wasn't any funding for a long time.
Yep. And even once there was funding, the funding in the cybersecurity space grew within DOD and the intelligence community much more quickly than it did on the civilian side. So it did take a while for DHS's portfolio to grow.
Okay. So a year or so ago, I think it was about a year ago, you announced that you were going to be leaving government. And we swapped emails. I said, I want you on the show. But, you know, the surprise for me is who you went to.
Yes, I moved to a company called Attain. I'm the Chief Technology Officer for Federal Services there. And Attain is a small, mid-sized company, recently outgrew small business status. And for me, one of the main priorities after a long government career where I had worked entirely within the federal government was to work in an organization that would be a good learning opportunity for me. I felt like I had, based on my background, a lot of value to bring to a company, but I also understood that there's a lot that is out there for me to learn about the business side of IT. And I was looking for a role where I would be involved in a variety of different aspects of the business, both internal, external, strategic, tactical, working with prospective customers, working with existing customers, and helping to influence the strategic technology direction of the company. And I thought that a smaller company would provide a better environment for me than some of the very large companies, which are very structured and perhaps have narrower swim lanes for senior executives and more narrowly defined roles.
Yeah. Another mutual friend of ours, Alan Balutis, helped you in the process with, you know, some suggestions, et cetera. What was Alan's role here?
Alan didn't put me in touch with Attain directly, but he did introduce me to a number of companies. And more importantly, as somebody who had made a similar type of transition farther back in the past, he was somebody who provided a lot of wisdom to me just in terms of the kinds of things I should be thinking about, the sort of things I should be looking for, and just helping me think about what was important to me as I conducted my search. So he provided a lot of thoughtful advice to me.
Did he suggest a Maryland company and not a Tyson's company?
No, he didn't. The big high-tech area in Maryland is really the biotech industry.
Right.
They're trying to grow a cybersecurity industry in Maryland now, but for the most part, the big IT tech companies are mostly in Northern Virginia. So
I got news for you. I'm in Columbia. We have a lot. And a lot of those are offices of Northern Virginia companies.
That is true. That is true.
But you know, Maryland's not shy in that arena. We have this little thing called Fort Meade over there.
I've heard of them.
And you know, they have a few other occupants besides the Army that may be of some interest. So if you want to meet anybody there, give me a shout. So,
I'll do that.
I know a couple of folks. So Attain had something in their portfolio. I mean, they are not a product company. They are a services company.
That's right. They do a variety of different types of management and technology consulting. It's a wide portfolio, but tending to focus on some higher value types of IT services as opposed to the very commoditized IT services that are perhaps a little more common across companies. They do some cloud work, some business intelligence and business process reengineering. They do big data work. They do a variety of different types of applications development and application support for government clients, including some mission type systems, not just commodity systems. They also do a bit of work, not as large as the federal practice, in the higher education space, and they have a small commercial practice as well.
Not bad portfolio for a small, mid-sized company. My guest today is Simone Sickman from Attain. I'm Mark Amtower, and you're listening to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We will be back after this. Welcome back to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is Simone Sickman, formerly of DOC, now with Attain. You're CTO with Attain?
That's right, CTO for Federal Services.
There you go. So let's talk about some of the issues facing the market at this time, the government and services contractors provide. Let's start with big data. What's the issue from government's point of view, and then give me a little bit of what Attain does here.
Well, I think the real issue for big data, I think it's a term of art that's certainly become a lot more common these days. But in a sense, depending on how you define it, big data has been around for a long time, particularly in the government, maybe even more so than in the private sector, because you've always had in the government applications, mission requirements that were pushing the limits and perhaps even exceeding the limits of what was commercially possible at the time. The National Weather Service has had some of the biggest supercomputers since way back in the 1950s, and they were doing big data in the 50s, although big data by those standards was perhaps a few megabytes of storage rather than
terabytes.
It's all
relative.
And so I think the government really has always had these cutting-edge needs, whether it's analytics to support weather modeling, analytics to support the warfighter in the theater. Clearly, there's been a lot of analytics work being a focus of the intelligence community for quite a long time. And I think the same missions that have always required it will continue to require it, but you're also now having an era of computing where the ability to create data is outpacing the ability to store it and process it and move it around, analyze it, and extract useful information from it. And so I think that's why big data is really becoming a more interesting space today, because it's now becoming an issue for many areas that were not some of those traditional ones that are dating back years or decades.
Okay. You had mentioned earlier that you had some involvement in high-performance computing. John McGoyle used to do a big conference up in New England on HPC in the 80s and 90s. Do you have any idea if that's still around?
I'm not sure. The one big supercomputing conference that I had been to in the past that is still around, happening annually, is the Supercomputing Conference, SC. So they'll do SC 2014, SC 2015, and that conference is still around. It's a conference where the research community, but also the private sector, the big players in that arena come together and exchange information. It's an interesting meeting.
Now, were you attending when you were in government?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So that in itself is an intriguing area, because the budgets for Fed's attending events has radically shrunk for a variety of reasons. What was your criteria for attending and letting your staff attend key
events?
My
attending that conference predates my role as a CIO at Commerce or at NIST. It was earlier in my career where I was really focused in helping to set the research agenda for high performance computing across the federal government, and so it was a very relevant type of meeting. I first got into this space around the time when Japan unveiled a supercomputer that leapfrogged the fastest supercomputer that the United States had. And so there was a lot of agitation, both in policy circles, political circles, and of course the academic research community worrying
Somebody
about
was
our,
pissed.
Yeah, I mean, just worried about our loss of leadership. And so that became an important area for some time there.
Yeah. You may have noticed at this point that I'm not particularly linear. So. Not known for that, Simone. All right, next issue, cloud. you're playing there, but it's, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, I had no clue what this thing was.
Well, I think cloud is one of those areas where it's been around longer in the commercial sector than in the federal government. The federal government was a little bit later to really get on board with cloud computing, but I think with the emergence of FedRAMP that provides a security framework for cloud computing, and also just a better understanding of the economic benefits of the technology and the proven applications that have been moved over to the cloud and successfully so, I think the government is certainly more interested and willing to adopt cloud technologies today than even a couple of years ago, let alone 5 years ago. Attain did some of the early agency email migrations for cloud computing, and it's an area that we're involved in still today. But speaking more generally, I think we're going to continue to see government moving more of their systems to the cloud, in part because of the economic benefits, but also the realization that that cloud technologies and cloud platforms can be managed securely enough to meet the government requirements as well as government perceptions of risk.
Well, that's a perfect segue for me, because my next question was going to deal with cyber, and I know that security and cloud was one of the seeming impediments for federal involvement.
I think it was definitely one of the impediments, whether it was rightfully so or not, I think is subject to debate, and there are different perspectives on it. I think certainly the framework for risk management in the cloud is necessarily a little bit different from how you manage systems that are under your own local technological control.
Right, but they're not necessarily more or less secure than those under your control.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's why I think one of the benefits of a FedRAMP as a cybersecurity framework is it establishes the baselines and the requirements for security in cloud systems. But to the point that you just made, I think there's no question that there are certainly some federal systems that are managed less securely than some cloud infrastructures. I think there's...
Is there anything that's not hackable?
I don't believe anybody would claim that there's something that's not hackable. Perhaps the closest you can get to it is a computer that's not connected to the internet, but but depending on how sophisticated you are, even those could be at risk.
Well, yeah, proximity. So what's Attain's role in the cyber world?
We don't have a tremendous cybersecurity practice at the moment. We do some cybersecurity work, but it's mainly in the form of implementing cybersecurity for the applications development and applications O&M services that we provide to our customers, and also supporting, since every agency has to go through an assessment and authorization process to put their systems into production, we support those processes as well, whether it's developing system security plans, other types of documentation, security testing of applications, and supporting that. So that's the type of role that we have in the cybersecurity arena today.
Okay, so it's not a focus practice.
Correct.
Okay. But it's got to be tied in to pretty much everything you do with big data, cloud, and our next topic.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, any type of services, whether it's cloud services, application development, hosting type services, you need to support the government in ensuring that their security requirements are being met. And so we certainly have the skills needed to be doing that.
Yeah. Health IT.
Health IT is another hot area, both in the military space as well as the civilian space. We do some work in the health IT area with the Department of Health and Human Services, some work in the Army, and we're also interested in supporting some of the work that's needed to look at things like information exchange for healthcare. Some analytics type work is other types of work that we're interested in, and that I think is an area where there's likely to be growing investment in the future, just because healthcare in general and delivery of healthcare is relying more on IT today than it did in the past.
Cool. Any other big topics jump out at you?
Nothing specific other than the fact that technology is really changing quickly. One of the interesting trends that the government has been seeing over the past few years is the entrance of technologies into the government space from the consumer market. And historically, it was almost the other way around. The government would adopt technologies based on what the government needed rather than things trickling in from the consumer market. But I think if you look at things like the use of tablets and smartphones and those types of technologies, they've really entered in almost sideways, because the people who worked for the governments or the customers of the government services were using these types of products and technologies in their home life, in their business life, in their personal life, and that created a new demand for the government to be able to deliver technologies on new platforms.
As CIO at Commerce, who did you offload the BYOD policy on?
BYOD is a very interesting question. Different agencies sort of different levels of adoption in that area. At Commerce, we were certainly interested in supporting BYOD, and there were a variety of conversations happening at the policy level about how to do that. We hadn't yet implemented a BYOD policy, mainly because we wanted to hold off on that. What we were, at the time that I left, we were in the process of migrating the entire department in pieces from internally managed email to cloud-based email. And in many organizations, as part of that migration, they were also moving off of the BlackBerry platform onto either Android or iPhone or both platforms. Mm-hmm. And so our intent was to complete those migrations and be able to ensure that we can effectively support non-BlackBerry mobile devices before we started letting people bring their own personal devices into the environment. So I think that that's something for my successor to have on his list of things to discuss, but it certainly was a topic of conversation.
Yeah, some of these things just they have to move on to the next generation. I'm Mark Amtower. You're listening to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest is Simone Sickman, and we'll be back after this. Welcome back to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is Simone Sickman, formerly the CIO of the Department of Commerce for the U.S. federal government and currently the CTO for Attain. Attain is attain.com, and they are in Vienna, Virginia, in the Tower Co. building.
That's correct.
There you go. Used to be one of my other favorite hangouts. But I don't like to drive to Virginia because it's a long haul from Columbia. So let's go back to your days as a Fed. You and I have known each other by reputation for a while, and we met because of some of my discussions on LinkedIn regarding strategic sourcing and other cost reduction tools in the federal arena. And we had pleasant but disagreeing conversations on these things. So let me ask, first of all, how long have you been on LinkedIn?
That's hard for me to say, long enough that I don't remember when I first got on, but it's definitely been a while.
Yeah. And for a senior visible Fed, you were quite early. And one of the things that I really liked about looking at your profile, especially after we connected, was seeing that list on the right side of your profile, who people also viewed, grow as far as other CIOs and CTOs. So was there anything particular about the platform that brought you in?
I think one of the main issues was just the ability to build and manage a network, help support some of the longer-term evolution of relationships with people that I knew well and people that I didn't know well but wanted to be able to reach out to and connect with. I think certainly one of the common reasons why people also join LinkedIn is just to be visible from a career development perspective, and that was one of the reasons that I had as well. But as you've often pointed out in your varied discussions about LinkedIn, there's also value in terms of being able to exchange views and perhaps gain information that you wouldn't have stumbled across otherwise through the groups that are available there. If you find an affinity group that has some kind of connection to something that you're interested in, it's a way to exchange opinions and views.
Yeah, and now there's over 2 million of those groups there to choose from. So, yeah, you have a lot to select from. And one of the things that I do when I'm looking particularly at people at your level, especially when you were in government, but also now that you're in industry, what groups do you choose to join on LinkedIn? That's important for people to take a look at. But one of the things that one of the reasons I'm talking about LinkedIn, not only I'm addicted to the platform, but I want to talk to you about, as a CIO at Commerce, as somebody at the Office of Science and Technology in the White House, there was a lot of people reaching out to you for a variety of reasons, speaking, business, let me take you to lunch, all of this stuff. How do you deal with this? And I want some insight for our audience as to is there an etiquette that should be employed here?
Sure. So I'm happy to give you my own personal views as long as listeners understand their personal views. I certainly...
It's not policy.
It's not even just that I don't want to speak for other people, but I'm sure there are very varied opinions and different perspectives, and people have different preferences about it. So I wouldn't want people to sort of have a pendulum swing in one direction or another based on my thoughts. But yes, I was approached very frequently by email, people calling my office through LinkedIn, in person often, from organizations that were interested in having me speak, serve on panels, either as a panelist or a moderator. And then also a lot of corporate business development came my way, people interested in chatting with me about the kinds of services that they thought that they could provide to Commerce. And, I have to say, from my perspective, there's no way to beat a personal relationship. And I think LinkedIn helps in developing those relationships, but there's also, a large number of different networking opportunities out there where you can get out there and meet people in person, shake their hands, give them your business card. And then when you try to connect with them later on, either by email or by LinkedIn, it's a familiar name. You have a face in your mind to go with it. And it's hard to attach a value to that kind of relationship building, but I think it's very important as part of what people should be doing to get things done.
Okay, that brings up another interesting point. When you were a Fed, did you belong to any professional associations, a firm, ACT IAC, PSC?
I was on the I'll probably get some of the terms wrong, but I was on an executive advisory board for ACT IAC. I was on an advisory council for GuyTech, as well as either FCA Bethesda or a firm. I don't recall which, but I certainly was involved in those organizations in a sort of an executive advisory type role. Mm-hmm. And that was a nice opportunity because those organizations really value the perspectives that they can get from senior government people in terms of what they want to see in their programming, in terms of how they support the government. And it was very valuable.
Yeah. And now that you're on the other side of the fence, have you selected any of those? PSC seems like a good one for Attain. ACT IAC remains a good one. But there's a few.
Attain is quite involved in, they're a member of the Professional Services Council. They're quite involved with ACT IAC, as well as Tech America and the Northern Virginia Technology Council. In fact, I came here directly from Northern Virginia Technology Council panel discussion that was sponsored by Attain down in Virginia today.
I love speaking there.
They're involved, yeah.
They're always, NVTC always has engaged audiences. Yep. I love that. Yeah.
And I've talked to leadership at Attain, and they're open to interacting with and becoming more connected with some of the other groups that they're perhaps not as involved with. It's just a matter of bandwidth and sort of assessing the return on investment there.
Well, you can't be part of everything when you're that size of company. So
correct.
If you were GDIT, yeah, you could send a few warm bodies pretty much to anybody.
Right.
But you're not. So that ROI has to be real. But, it's like LinkedIn. If you're going to join to get value out of it, you've got a participation level.
That's right. That's right. And it is, you know, it's not just a financial commitment if you're a sponsor, but it's also the time commitment of having people who work for the company be involved in different groups and committees.
Yeah. So here's, you know, go back to your last role at Commerce. You have these various groups that want to get you to come speak, but you had to have offers like on an hourly basis. So how do you select?
I mean, when it comes to speaking opportunities, I was one of the main drivers was just the size and breadth of the audience. I typically, I don't want to say exclusively, but typically didn't accept speaking invitations that were just for one company's meeting, a meeting that was organized by one company just around their space, their technology, and their customers. Because I felt like a lot of the value that I could bring as a speaker was really helping to telegraph out to the public and the private sector, more importantly, what the agency's priorities were, what my priorities were, what some of our directions were, mainly because the idea was not just for me to be able to hear myself talk, but really to inform the private sector so that they would be in a better position to then come back to the government and deliver products, technologies, services to the government that were more effectively matched to our needs. And so my interest was really in being able to help educate people on what we needed, what we wanted, and where we were going with technology.
Okay. Now, one of the things that always amuses me at big events like that is the line that forms to talk to you afterwards.
Yes.
How long do you stay, and how many cards do you actually collect and use?
You know, there are people who will sneak out a back door behind a curtain before the...
You weren't one.
No, I would... there were occasions when I actually had to run somewhere else and had to apologize and leave. But if I didn't have to be somewhere, I would stay there until the line was gone. Because I was always interested in meeting new people and hearing from folks. And you never know how somebody you meet unexpectedly can provide some value in the future. Really turn out to be perhaps an unexpected match. And like I said earlier, the benefit of meeting people is building those relationships as opposed to getting a cold call or an unsolicited email later on where you're just, to be honest, given the volume of those types of knocks on the door, it's just more likely to get overlooked.
Okay. My guest today is obviously Simone Sickman from Attain. I'm Mark Amtower. You're listening to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We will be back after this. Welcome back to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is Simone Sickman of Attain. And let's once again go back to your role at Commerce, at White House, any part of government you were in. Companies want to connect with and meet senior people for sometimes the right reason, sometimes wrong. Let me preface this by saying this. I've been asked probably, when you were still CIO, I was asked probably at least 100 times for an intro to you, and I said, why? And they said, well, because he runs this. I'm going, no, he's got people that run that. Those are the people you need to meet. So let's talk about who contractors need to meet and how they go about it.
Well, that's a terrific question. And I think the point that you brought up is one of the key points, which frankly, a surprising number of companies somehow don't appreciate is really gaining some understanding of who the decision makers are, who are the influential people that you actually want to be talking to. And there have been a variety of situations where people would knock on my door and ask for some of my time, and I would say, look, I'm often happy to talk to industry, but for this particular thing, I'm not the right person. There were a lot of technologies, a lot of services being managed at levels below me. I had a CTO, deputy CIO and CTO who worked for me, and a director of IT services under him. And so many of the decisions about technology selection were not made by me. Often the acquisition decisions and source selection were not decisions being made by me. And frankly, if the company reps, whether it's technology and engineering people or sales people or business development people, if they want to get a good return on investment for their time, they should be talking to the people who are influential. And sometimes it takes a little bit of research to find out who those people are.
But it doesn't take a lot of research. I mean, if somebody goes to the Department of Commerce website and clicks on the CIO office, there's this little org chart that shows up, you know?
Yep. You're right. It doesn't take that much time. And there are other areas where I would similarly say it doesn't take that much time to do a little bit of homework, and that homework really pays dividends. People would probably not be surprised to hear that I got a lot of phone calls and unsolicited emails, but the volume really became beyond what I could readily manage. And what that meant, unfortunately, was often a lot of those calls or emails would go unreturned. I would occasionally politely respond when I could, but I just didn't have enough hours in the day to do it all the time. And one of the things that struck me is, on occasion, somebody would just send me an email cold. I never heard of them before, saying, here's our capability sheet. Let me know how we can help you. And I'll be honest, I don't have the time to spend my time assessing every company that's out there and figuring out how they can help me. So for me, what really...
But you're a public servant. You're supposed to.
Well, I'm busily employed and have a lot of stuff to do. So one of the best things that I would advise companies to do is do that research. I mentioned earlier, I was out there talking on the circuit often about all sorts of priorities, whether it was data centers or cloud or analytics and big data, cybersecurity. You could Google my name, and I was out there being quoted at panels and conferences. So,
and you're on Federal News Radio.
And Federal News Radio. And yes, had done some interviews with your colleagues here. So it shouldn't be that hard to do enough homework to be able to walk in saying, here's how I think I can help you, as opposed to saying, here's what we do. What can we do for you? Hmm. And with all due respect to the many companies that are out there doing great work, there are so many of them out there who believe they have something to offer that they have to work to be competitive and really show how they can bring value to the government clients.
Are you asking them to differentiate themselves?
Well, I think differentiating themselves is certainly a challenge for everybody, but I think walking in the door with an idea of who you're talking to, what their priorities are, and how you can help them with their priorities has tremendous value. And there are a surprising number of companies that, in my experience, didn't take the time to do that.
Yeah. And not only did they waste your time, but the next time a representative from that company called, the likelihood is, and I'm speculating here, that a meeting would not occur.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll give one more again, just from my own experience, when I got emails that were very clearly form letters, because they would say, "Dear Mr. Zickman, we would really like to know how we can help your company," as opposed to your agency. So it's obviously just a cut and paste, or you know, the types of email blasts that have unsubscribe links at the bottom. I would automatically unsubscribe to those, not because that technology didn't have something that had value or that was worthwhile, but the initial message to me, if it has an unsubscribe link, it's going to dozens, hundreds, thousands of people. And if the message isn't tailored to me and my priorities and what my agency needs and the types of things that I'm trying to accomplish, there are many other companies who are taking the time to do that. And so I would say it's important to tailor your communications and really understand who you're talking to and focus on what's important to them.
Yeah. And, you know, unless you're targeting procurement offices and you're selling hammers and nails or desks and chairs, but even then the relationships are important. They have to know the source of this stuff.
So, that is true.
That's key. So, thank you for sharing that first, because it's a recurrent message that I try to get out. But when it comes from somebody like you who's been there and been on the receiving end, it carries somewhat more weight. But I want to go back to close this out and talk about the emerging role of social media as a meeting ground, particularly LinkedIn as a meeting ground for the community. So I consider this a community, the feds, the contractors, the companies that support both sides, you know, even insurance and healthcare firms. So it doesn't matter who you are, this is an ecosystem, and right. we have to have a common ground to meet. And from my experience, I've been, Amtower & Company turns 30 on January 1. I've been advising companies in the government market for over 30 years, and I've worked with NIST, some of the groups out there, FASEA, way back, the CD-ROM Applications and Technology Group, way, way back. So, I've never seen a system like LinkedIn where so much can possibly be done. So go back again and tell me a little bit about why you joined and how you used it as a Fed.
Sure. Again, speaking for myself, I was interested in helping to build and manage a network. And in my line of business, the network grows quickly because you meet a lot of people when you're out there talking at conferences and panels, and there are a lot of companies that want to connect with people at my level in the government. I think the benefit of the LinkedIn platform is just the ability to do that quickly, seamlessly, at a distance, but also to make that network persistent over time. So I could have met somebody 2 or 3 years ago, and maybe I haven't bumped into them for a really long time, but I know that if I ever need to reach out to them for a particular reason with a question, looking for something, that I can readily find them. I was never one of those people who scanned in business cards because I got so many of them and kept a database of them. So for me, LinkedIn was very useful in that way. The other thing that I did is, even though I was a government person, I didn't feel like I needed LinkedIn to keep a pulse on what was going on in the government space, because I interacted very frequently with people on my staff, people in other organizations in my agency, other CIOs at other agencies, OMB and the policy levels within the federal government. So my use of LinkedIn was really to help take the pulse of the private sector. And I was a member of numerous groups that were related to government IT on the private sector side. There are, as you mentioned, probably many more groups than any one person can easily manage. But I was a member of several of the groups out there, including yours, Mark. And so for me, just being able to listen and eavesdrop on the types of conversations that were going on there was helpful. We first met after the issue of strategic sourcing became a topic of conversation. There have also been many conversations around LPTA, as well as technology priorities, including the ones we've talked about, cybersecurity and big data analytics and cloud. And so for me, being able to just hear from the private sector, hear what they were thinking, understand what was important to them, honestly, understanding some of their frustrations was helpful to me as well. For me, probably people didn't necessarily notice that I was there because I was a very silent participant. I would listen and read conversations. I didn't do a lot of posting and commenting. And in fact, even our discussion, I took it out of band and responded to you via email rather than right. on LinkedIn.
Right.
And the real reason for that is just because it's hard to speak publicly without it being viewed as an official position. And you don't want to either be perceived as doing that by the private sector or be perceived internally within the agency as doing that without going through public affairs. And so that sort of public online conversation that stays on the record is, frankly, it's just a little more difficult for government people to engage in.
You also sent that email to me from your private email account.
That probably is true.
I still have the email.
Yeah.
So, Simone, thank you so much for coming in, man. This has been great. So once you've further ensconced yourself there at Attain. Let's do it again so we can take a deeper dive into what you guys are doing.
I'd be happy to come back anytime, and it was great finally meeting you in person after a long series of communications.
Rumor and innuendo. There you go. You've been listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is not my day job. If you need help on the marketing side of government, particularly if you need help leveraging LinkedIn, give me a call. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net, or look me up and look Simon up on LinkedIn. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.